Ever get that stack of paperwork when you're starting a new job?
Oh, yeah.
Benefits, forms, all that stuff.
Definitely.
It can be so overwhelming.
It really can. Like you said, a whole other language sometimes.
Totally. And there's almost always this thing called group life insurance buried in there somewhere.
Right.
And today we're diving into that. What is it, really? How does it
Existential.
work? And why should you actually care? We'll uncover how this whole idea even came about and what it looks like now.
Absolutely. Our aim today is to take the mystery out of group life insurance. We've been looking at its history, its origins, and how it functions in today's world to help you make sense of this very common employee benefit.
It's really interesting, isn't it, how this idea of people coming together for mutual support has been around for centuries.
Absolutely.
Like one thing that struck me from the research was those medieval guilds. You know, we often think of them for their crafts and trades,
Right.
but they were also about protecting their members.
Exactly.
If someone hit hard times, the guild would step in to help. It's fascinating to see that kind of early version of group security as a forerunner to modern group insurance.
It really is that thread of mutual aid running through history.
Okay, so let's fast forward to today. You see group life insurance on that benefits form. What are we actually talking about in the 21st century?
So at its core, group life insurance is one policy that covers a whole bunch of people.
Oh, okay.
The big difference here is an individual life insurance policy, which is for just one person. But because group life insurance covers so many, the cost for each person, the premiums, is usually less.
Makes sense. Spreading the risk makes it cheaper per person.
Exactly. It often means significant savings compared to buying an individual policy, which could free up money for other things.
Got it. So cheaper is good, but it can't be just any group of people getting together for a discount, right?
You're absolutely right. There are rules. A key one is that the group has to exist for a reason other than just getting insurance.
Makes sense.
Can't be a bunch of folks just trying to game the system for cheap premiums. Our sources highlight several types of eligible groups.
So what are we talking about here? Like, the most obvious one is probably employer groups.
Right. Employer group plans, or sometimes called employee group plans, are probably the most common.
Okay, so that's for folks working at a company. What else?
Then there are what are called multiple employer trusts, or METs. These are really interesting. Think of them like small business co-ops for benefits. It allows smaller companies who maybe couldn't get great rates on their own to band together sometimes within similar industries and offer a more attractive benefits package, including group life insurance.
Oh, interesting. Strength in numbers for the small businesses.
Exactly. And they can often get some tax advantages too. Then, of course, there are labor unions. They frequently sponsor group plans for their members. And sometimes they do this through something called Taft-Hartley trusts, especially when you've got agreements involving multiple unions.
Okay, so we've got employers, these small business co-ops, unions. What other kinds of groups get in on this action?
Well, there are also association group plans. Think professional organizations, trade associations, that kind of thing. They offer group life insurance as a PUC to their members. And then there's a slightly different category, group credit life insurance. This one's typically offered by a lender, like a bank or credit union, to a borrower.
Credit life insurance, yeah, I've seen that on loan paperwork. What makes that one different?
A couple of key things. First, with group credit life insurance, the payout often goes straight to the lender, not to your family.
So if you pass away, it takes care of the debt.
Right. Second, the amount of coverage matches the loan balance.
Yeah.
So say you've got a car loan.
Yeah.
As you pay it down, the life insurance shrinks too.
Makes sense. It's specifically designed to cover that loan. Okay, so with all these different groups, how does the insurance part actually work? Does everyone get their own little mini policy?
Not exactly. Here's how it goes. The sponsoring group, whether it's your employer, the union, whatever, they get one big master policy.
Okay.
They're the policy holder. You, as the employee or union member, you don't deal with that master policy directly. Instead, everyone covered gets a certificate of insurance.
Ah, so the master policy is like the main agreement,
Right.
and the certificate is your proof that you're part of it.
You got it. It lays out the important details of your coverage.
Okay, so my certificate says I'm covered. What else does it tell me?
Well, it'll have your unique certificate number and, really importantly, who you've named as your beneficiary. That's the person of people who would get the death benefit. Even though you're not the one holding the master policy, you, as the certificate holder, get to choose where that money goes.
Got it. Now, sometimes the employee pays part of the cost. Sometimes the employer covers it all. What are those different arrangements called?
You're talking about contributory and non-contributory plans.
Right.
In a contributory plan, you, the employee, pay some of the premium, and your employer often kicks in the rest. But here's the thing. For a contributory plan to even happen, at least 75% of eligible employees have to sign up and pay their share.
Wow, 75%. That seems high.
It is. And it can be a challenge for employers to reach that. You know, sometimes employees don't see the immediate value, or maybe they're juggling other financial priorities.
And what if they don't hit that 75%?
Well, then the insurance company might not even offer the plan. You know, low participation could be a red flag to them, suggesting higher risk.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So what about non-contributory plans?
In a non-contributory plan, the employer foots the entire bill for everyone who's eligible.
Nice.
And because the employer is paying the whole thing, these plans usually require 100% participation.
Okay, makes sense. Now, let's talk about the application process. With individual life insurance, there are all those health questions, maybe even a medical exam. How does that work with group life insurance when so many people are covered under one policy?
This is actually a big draw for a lot of people. With group life insurance, the insurer is underwriting the group as a whole, not each individual person.
Ah, so they're looking at the big picture risk of the whole group.
Exactly. It's different from individual policies where they scrutinize your medical history. Usually, you just fill out a short form with basic info, name, address, social security number, who you want to be your beneficiary, that kind of thing. And here's the biggie. Usually, no medical questions, no medical exam.
Wow, that is huge, especially if you have a pre-existing condition that might make it hard to get individual insurance.
Absolutely. It takes away a major obstacle.
Okay, so if they're not looking at individual health, how do they determine the premiums for the whole group?
Good question. Once the group plan's up and running, premiums are usually based on the claims experience of the group.
So how many people in that group actually end up using the insurance?
Exactly. Most group policies renew every year, and the premiums can change based on those claims.
So if it's a healthy group, premiums might stay low, but if a lot of claims are made,
premiums could go up.
Gotcha.
And underwriters, the folks assessing the risk, they also look at things like the stability of the group. You know, how much turnover is there? How often are employees coming and going?
Makes sense, yeah. A company with lots of turnover might be seen as riskier.
Exactly. They also consider something called persistency. Like, how often does the group switch insurance providers?
That's interesting.
And of course, they check, again, that the group's main purpose isn't just buying insurance.
Right. Can't just be a scheme to get cheap rates.
Exactly.
Okay, so who decides who is eligible for the group life insurance offered by an employer? Can they cherry pick?
Nope. Employers can't say, we'll cover you, but not you, if those employees are in the same category.
Right, so no playing favorites.
Right. But they can define classes of employees that are eligible.
Okay.
Our research shows that the most common distinctions are full-time versus part-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
And how long someone's worked for the company, their years of service.
So an employer could say, you have to be full-time and have worked here for at least a year to qualify.
Exactly. And another common requirement is that employees have to be in active status to enroll.
What does active status mean?
It basically means they're actively working, not on, say, disability leave or something.
Makes sense.
So you can't be on leave and then try to sign up.
Got it. Okay, so what about new hires? Are they covered right away?
Typically, there's a probationary period for new employees.
Okay.
It's a waiting period before they're eligible for the group life insurance. These periods vary anywhere from 1 to 12 months, and it's up to the employer to decide how long it is. But important point here, they have to apply this probationary period fairly to all eligible employees.
Right. No discrimination. Okay. So you make it through this probationary period, then what? How do you actually enroll and get covered?
Well, with a non-contributory plan, remember, the employer is paying everything. You typically get covered automatically once that waiting period's over. But with a contributory plan, where the employee shares the cost, there's a specific window called the enrollment period, usually about 31 days. During that time, employees decide whether they want in. And if they sign up during this initial enrollment period, there are no medical questions, no exam.
Like an open door to get covered.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea is to prevent a situation where only people who think they'll need the insurance soon are the ones signing up.
Right. It keeps things balanced.
Right. And it helps keep the premium stable for everyone.
So what happens if you miss that initial window and want to enroll later?
If someone says no thanks during that initial enrollment and then changes their mind down the road, it gets trickier.
Oh, okay.
The insurance company might start asking medical questions, even require a medical exam.
Ah, makes sense.
And a lot of plans limit these late enrollees to signing up only during the open enrollment period, which usually happens once a year. So it really highlights the importance of taking that initial enrollment seriously.
Definitely. Don't wait if you think you might need it. Okay, so we've got all these people covered under the group plan. How do they figure out how much life insurance each person gets? Is it just a standard amount for everyone?
Not always. While the coverage doesn't have to be identical for everybody, it has to be calculated with a formula.
Okay.
And that formula's got to be applied fairly to everyone in a particular employee category. We found a few common formulas employers and unions use.
Lay them on me.
A very common one is basing coverage on a percentage or multiple of the employee's earnings.
Okay, I've seen that before.
Like, an employer might offer life insurance equal to your yearly salary, maybe half your salary, or even two or three times your salary.
Right.
Another way is to tie it to your years of service, how long you've been with the company.
Oh, interesting.
So, for example, you might get $5,000 in coverage for every year you've worked there.
I see. So if you've been there for 2 years, you'd get $10,000. But if you've been there 10 years, you'd get $50,000.
Exactly.
Okay, those are pretty straightforward. Any other common ways they figure it out?
The third common way is to set specific limits for different types of employees.
Okay.
For example, regular employees might get $20,000 in coverage. Supervisors might get $50,000. And executives could have $100,000.
Makes sense. Different levels of responsibility.
Right. And one more thing to remember. If the plan covers dependents.
Like spouses and kids.
Right. Their coverage is usually less than what the employee gets.
Okay, that makes sense. Speaking of dependents, who typically qualifies as a dependent under these group plans?
Usually it's the employee's spouse, their children.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes even dependent parents or others who rely on the employee financially. And as we talked about, the coverage amount for dependents is usually lower than the employees.
Right, right. Now, we've talked about how group life insurance is often tied to your job or being in a union. But what happens if you leave that job or the group dissolves? Do you just lose the insurance altogether?
It's a good question, and it's something to consider. In most cases, yes, you and any dependents you have on the plan would lose coverage if you leave your employer.
Okay.
The same goes if the employer decides to drop the group life insurance plan altogether, or if the insurance company decides not to renew the policy for the whole group. And dependents can also lose coverage if the employee who got them on the plan passes away, or if there's a divorce.
Okay, so a lot of things can trigger a loss of coverage.
Right.
Which would leave people scrambling to find new insurance, maybe when their health isn't as good. Is there anything that can be done to bridge that gap if you lose group coverage?
Luckily, there often is. There's a thing called a conversion privilege.
Okay.
This gives you, the certificate holder and your dependents, the right to convert your group coverage into an individual policy.
Oh, that sounds potentially very useful.
It can be a real lifesaver.
So what are the rules around using this conversion privilege? Any catches?
The fine print can vary a bit depending on what state you're in, but there's some common threads. Typically, you have to act fast, usually within 31 days of your group coverage ending. And the policy you switch to has to be a permanent life insurance policy, not a term policy.
Okay.
The coverage amount has to stay the same as what you had under the group plan.
Got it.
But, and this is important, the premium for this new individual policy is based on your age at the time of conversion. So it could be a lot more expensive than what you were paying under the group plan.
Right, because you're older now.
Exactly. But the good news is, you usually don't have to prove you're healthy to do this conversion.
So even if your health has taken a hit since you first got the group coverage,
you can still convert to an individual policy without a medical exam.
That is a big deal, a real safety net.
Yeah.
What happens during that 31-day conversion period? Are you still covered while you're making up your mind?
You are. Coverage continues throughout that whole 31 days. So even if you hadn't finished all the paperwork and, you know, dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, if the insured person passes away during that time, the death benefit would still be payout, just as if they had already converted to an individual policy.
Wow, that's great. It gives people some breathing room and peace of mind during that transition. Okay, so we talked earlier about group credit life insurance that lenders often offer. How does that compare to just going out and buying an individual life insurance policy yourself and then maybe assigning the death benefit to the lender as collateral?
That's a smart question to ask. So, with Group Credit Life, like we discussed, the coverage is directly tied to how much you owe.
Right. So if it's for a par loan and you pay down the loan,
the insurance coverage goes down too.
Got it.
And the lender is the one who benefits from the payout. Now, on the flip side, you could buy your own individual policy for a similar amount and then tell the insurance company, hey, if I die, pay out this benefit to the lender.
Okay. So you're basically using your own policy to back up the loan. So if someone's weighing their options when taking out a loan, what are the real pros of choosing an individual policy over the group credit life insurance the lender's dangling in front of them?
Couple of big ones. First, with your own individual policy, you are in control. You make the decisions. With group credit life, the lender calls the shots.
Ah, okay.
And secondly, your individual policy doesn't have to end when the loan is paid off. You can keep it going.
So it can continue to provide coverage even after the debt's gone.
Exactly. You've got options.
Okay, so that's the upside. What about the downsides? Why might someone choose the group credit life over an individual policy?
Well, sometimes the premiums for an individual policy can be higher than the group credit life insurance.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And like we talked about before, you usually have to prove you're in good health to get an individual policy, which you don't usually have to do for group credit life.
Right. Those medical questions and exams again. So there's a trade-off to consider.
Exactly. It's all about figuring out what makes the most sense for your situation.
Okay, wow. We have covered so much ground today. We've gone from the historical roots of group life insurance all the way to the nitty-gritty of how it works and what happens when life throws you a curveball. So, as we wrap things up, what are the key takeaways you think listeners should really remember about group life insurance?
The biggies are that group life insurance can be a really convenient and often very affordable way to get life insurance coverage.
Uh-huh.
And often without needing a medical exam, which, like we said, is a big deal for a lot of people. It's usually tied to your job or being part of a group, and there are formulas for figuring out how much coverage you get.
Right.
But really important to remember, your coverage could disappear if you leave the group. So understanding those rules is crucial. And don't forget about that conversion privilege.
Right. That option to switch it to an individual policy can be so important. Well, as you're looking over those benefits forms and trying to decide what's right for you, here's a final thought to ponder. Given how easy it often is to get group life insurance, often without those tricky medical underwriting hoops to jump through, how might having this coverage, even if it's not a massive amount, fit into your long-term financial plans? Especially when you're also thinking about whether or not you might need individual life insurance down the line, or thinking about that conversion option we talked about, what situations in life might make exploring that option really critical for you and your family's financial well-being. Really worth taking some time to think about your own needs based on everything we've talked about today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure. Always great to talk about this stuff.